This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Yeah, my hope is that they carry it on, you know, they carry on the storytelling and not only the written, but the writing lyrics.
Hiya, I'm Cesara Krishnaz and this is Season 2 of Songlines. The month of Makaro is a very special one because we were graced in the studio by Waamujari elder, international blues and gospel singer-songwriter, teacher, mentor, human rights advocate and political activist Kankoa Nagara, also known as Olive Knight. With roots in Western Australia's Kimberley region, Kankoa found her voice in the country, blues and rock music of her youth, which was spent in missions across the state. Despite a rough start in life, her natural talent and generous spirit led her to a career in music, with performances spanning local gospel choir stages to singing with Hugh Jackman on Broadway. As well as this, she was central in developing the Waamujari Dictionary to preserve her local language and continues to bring greater awareness of and prevention efforts to end substance abuse within Indigenous communities across Australia. We're in Makaro and this is Kankoa Nagara. Welcome back to Boorloo.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What is your favourite part about travelling down south?
My favourite part is because being a musician, that's the priority. The love for the music, meeting people, hearing different sounds in the of what we call music. And so it's all entwined in the fact that as a musician, that is what brings me here. I'd say it's the top priority.
Can you tell us a bit about where you're from?
I'm from the Fitzroy Crossing area.
Mm-hmm.
I'm affiliated with three tribes.
Mm-hmm.
My desert affiliation is with my grandmother, the Waamujari people. And I was born on Kuniyandi land, which was my grandfather's country. And then I'm affiliated with the river tribes of the Boonuba people, where my grandfather came from. I'm also a traditional owner of the Dungawarawara people. So that is where I speak the three languages of my three tribes, yes. I'm quite fluent in the Kuniyandi and the Waamujari language.
Oh, that's incredible. This whole episode is actually just me thinking you're the coolest person in the world and trying not to gush too much. This episode will be released in the Noongar season of Makaro, which is kind of around like the winter time. What's it like up north that time of year in like June, July?
Yeah, well, I'm quite interested to just hear you say Makaro. Makaro is the word for our winters up there. You know, in
really? Wollongong. Is it the same thing up there?
Yeah.
That's so cool. It's really interesting how like language travels across.
That's right. So Makaro in Waamujari is winter time.
Oh, I love that. It's really interesting how words travel and how some words are quite similar to one another.
True.
That's very cool. So you mentioned that you grew up on country.
Yes.
It's a really simple question, but what was that like growing up on
growing
your
up
own
on country?
Country
was fabulous. I can only describe it as one of the most unique times and the most precious times I spent growing up on country, because I always tell the people about my existence as when I roamed the desert as a nomad with my clan. I grew up with men of the clan because I was the eldest of all of their children, you know, and one of them had a couple of wives and all the. So I'd be taken care of by the men. There were five of them, and I was a great, see, traditionally to at least three of those men, and they'd be carrying me around, you know, piggyback and all that, and teaching me how to hunt and track the animals and all that. So my stepfather was a desert man from the Madu country, and he taught me how to track the animals like goanna and all those other things, and taught me how to hunt and treated me like a boy. And I passionately, so fondly remember all my times, and sometimes it becomes quite emotional when I talk about this and how my stepfather adopted me. And it was at a time in the 1930s, 40s, where our people were very strong in culture and law, and if they adopted another child, they were given a wife with a child, they destroy the child, you know.
And, oh, wow.
Because the child wasn't theirs. But this one took me in and lovingly cared for me and was so intense in teaching me and taking care of me. So I just fondly remember those times. And as I said, I sometimes remember them with emotion, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I love this so much. I really do love my job sometimes. People know you for your storytelling and your music. And now this isn't something I clocked before this was organized. You've toured with Hugh Jackman. I'm an ex-WAPA student, so Hugh Jackman is a true legend in that building. Aside from Hugh Jackman, we'll put him to the side. You've also performed in Nan Up this year, released five albums, and in the 60s helped develop the, I'm going to try to say this properly, but listeners, if I don't, I apologise, Walmudari Dictionary.
Yes.
What role has stories played in your life? Like, have they always been a massive part of it, or was that something that came along later?
The stories did play massive parts in my life. It was quite adamant that our tribes were had instilled and ingrained these stories into our being, more or less. You know?
It's part of us.
Yeah, part of us. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have them, well, you're sort of not with it. You're kind of floating, you know, mm-hmm. somewhere. And the stories mean a lot for us as Indigenous people, because I remember when traveling as a nomad with my people, there was an elder there who would get up every night and repeat the same thing night after night, but he'd speak it in riddles, and I was a child there, and they'd shut me up so that I could listen to the riddles.
I'm forgetting the same thing.
And decipher the story, because you didn't hear the story, see? It was spoken in riddles until then later as you grew, when it was repeated, when you grew up, then you begin to put the stories together and understand why he did it and what he said there.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Mm. And also just, I want to say cool again, but how many times can I say cool in one podcast is really the question. So I suppose you've said stories and words have always been massively important.
Mm, that's right.
I mean, it's part of our culture. Mm. When did you discover blues?
Blues came as a succession of other trying out other genres, you know.
Yeah.
First it was country and western, and then it was rock and roll and mimicking Buddy Holly, all those people, and Cliff Richard, please don't tease me, and that sort of thing. And then I start, when my people started using the two-way radio, you know, not the two-way radio, but the radios that were sold at the time by hawkers, you know, that, and then blues, you'd hear this strange music called the blues, and I thought, my word, this is really so suited to me, you know, and our culture, our songs are so repetitive, you know,
it's just
the beat and everything, and that's how our people learned it, see, by repetitiveness, or you know, you just spoken words as well as sung words, you know.
I think you actually just answered what I was going to ask you, but I think I'm still going to ask you because I just like to hear you talk about it.
Yeah.
Why did you fall in love with it, and why have you stayed with it?
Well, that's purely for the fact, as I said, it had the repetitive, the attraction to it was the repetitive nature of the blues. You know, when you hear the old blues, you know, greats, you hear that they keep repeating the same lines over and over again, and as well as the sound of it, because it had some connection with the beat of our boomerangs and the thump thump of the nalanala on the ground. You know, it's sort of the same kind of almost connected with this type of music. I suppose it's all because of our ancestry. You know, the people in the blues brought their music from Africa, you know. So the connection in the long run was, I suppose, it's all spiritual or, you know.
Yeah. I'd never thought of it like that before. And now that I think about it, it makes so much sense. Not almost cyclical nature to it and the way it kind of starts where it ends.
Yes.
That's so fun. I could honestly listen to you talk about that probably all day. So now I really do have to get onto the topic of Hugh Jackman, because I just can't not. So your career took off when you started to collaborate with different artists who you crossed paths with, including Hugh Jackman, who in 2011 invited you to be part of his Broadway production, Hugh Jackman's Back on Broadway, and in 2019, to his world tour. I have to say, I definitely would have seen you in 2019, and I probably thought you were incredible.
Thank you.
So how did you end up in New York?
First, I had created my first album. It was called Gospel Blues at the Edge of the Desert. And at the same time, he was formulating his new, his first Broadway show. And he had kind of, you know, he had spoken with my son and another the man whom I called his son. He lived in New York, you know, and I gave him a skin group and all that. And they had formed this company called Nomads Two Worlds, and and they had made some sort of agreement with Hugh Jackman, and then they spoke about bringing someone and sort of more or less showcasing the indigenous the culture and the people, you know, to abroad. So he. Then when he heard about me, I said, look, well, yeah, I'm just willing to do it. I'm on the go and do it for him. And so they got me on board. But at the same time, he's looking for a lot of musicians all over this country.
Yeah.
And somehow he was unsuccessful for some reason or other. So I came on board and he heard my songs and my record, my first album. And so he said, well, bring that one over, you know. And straight to Toronto, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so there we were. There I am flying Cathay Pacific in my own little compartment on the plane.
Wow, that is cool.
And, oh, dear me, it was lovely. And then I'll tell a lot of funny stories about it because...
Please do.
When I first went to New York to my son's exhibition, well, he was there, of course, and the paparazzi was around him and
oh,
all that
gosh.
Sort of
thing.
So we couldn't get near. So at this dinner, I eventually got near because I needed a photograph for my little community, Wangajuga. Because the kids were, I had worked in the community as a school-based officer and I was going abroad. And so I told them, look, oh, guess what I'm going to see? And they said, oh, please show us the claws. Show us the claws.
The claws.
Oh, it was so funny. And I did come back, photographed with him, and I said, well, there are no claws. Look, this is just an ordinary man. So, yeah, they are so fascinated with all the sci-fi movies and all that over there. Then they were much more thrilled that I'd actually been with him and on his tour and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I didn't really know him. I knew about the Wolverine series and all that sort of thing. But then I had to hire out a Wolverine, oh, I think it was, what was it, the first?
X-Men.
X-Men, yeah. An X-Men movie to watch the man, you know, on because I was so nervous, you know, to be appearing
for the first time
with him in Toronto. So I had to watch the X-Men movie and think, you know, more or less says, oh, it's going to give me the real man, you know, I'm going to come face to face with. But it didn't.
No, so, no, I think we've so done like the opposite.
Yeah, it did the opposite. Oh, dear me. X-Men, I thought, you know.
Because isn't the first scene like him in a cage fight or something? Wow, yes, one way to make you comfortable with Hugh Jackman is to watch him in the first X-Men movie.
Yes, and so there I was, oh dear me, and a lot of other stories which I do not want to disclose at the moment, you know. And having watched him on the movie Australia and all that and telling the crowd and all that sort of thing, and yeah, so it was good.
Oh, that's incredible. So... you said in your interviews about the tour that the opportunity would be a dream come true.
Yes,
but
it was.
Also a chance to raise awareness of the heartbreaking issues kind of facing your people.
That's right.
Do you feel a responsibility when you're performing, especially off country and especially like outside of Australia, to share the experiences of your people?
I favour the idea of educating the world, you know, about what I stand for and who we are here in this country, and like basically who we are as an Indigenous people with traditions and with our own very, very strong, that we very strong culture where we want to share with the world and we want to educate the world. Now, out there, with a couple of shows that I did with him, I advocated the fact that at one with nature, you know, I advocated the fact of climate change. I'm an advocate of the climate change, of course, and so that's what I advocated in most of my show most of the time with him. We sung songs, of course, and also the language. I translated Somewhere Over the Rainbow with him into my Olmajeri language, and we sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow on stage all over the world, so in Olmajeri. So.
Oh my God, I wish I had a clearer mouth. I wish I was older when I'd seen that. That's beautiful. Oh, wow.
Yeah, he quickly picked it up too, because being an actor, I suppose it was no problem to him.
Yeah, he's a very interesting dude to watch when he performs.
Yes, he's just cute, yeah.
But alas, this is not the Hugh Jackman podcast. But maybe one day I'll interview him for something.
Yeah,
who knows? Kind of shifting away from touring and from Hugh Jackman. He can go to the side now. Songwriting process. What is your songwriting process? Where do you draw inspiration from? Is it the same place or is it different things that kind of put themselves together?
Well, different things that put themselves together. During my time at school, many years ago, but my love was for poetry and for the English language. And so I explored, you know, plays like, you know, I loved Shakespeare's plays and also all of the poetry, the old English poetry and all that. And so hence the fact that that is what has brought me to a place of like, more or less the love for poetry and the love for writing and prose and all that sort of thing. So my songwriting is all about, you know, having to be given or instilled that love in the first place, you know. And so you carried it on, and so you explore the other means of presenting, you know, yourself as a writer and, you know, and songwriting and doing so. And that is, it's definitely at its roots in my learning poetry and loving it at school.
Yeah. No, yeah, that makes sense. And pulling out the good old thesaurus when the one word you want doesn't sound right. And you're like, no, I need another word.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's always really astounding sometimes.
But it becomes difficult when you start trying to write a song in the standard English, and then you transcribe it or translate it into your own language.
Yeah, what's that like? Because
that is good. That is good. I find it easy. I'm a trained interpreter with my language, and as well as interpreter and a translator. Yeah.
Do you? Okay. So this is always a question I've had when I've, you know, with translation and because I have, you know, similar questions when it's translated into my language, into Noongar, especially with things like songs where the rhythm and the kind of number of syllables are important, I suppose. How does that work when you translate it from English into language and the syllables? Like the number of syllables kind of shift. Like, is that something you think about, or do you just kind of go with it and make it work?
Yeah, you go with it and make it work, because the thing is, you have to know what really fits in your language. You know? If it doesn't fit in the English language, well, look, keep true to your language. You know? Because that is the way the children are going to sing it. That is the way we are going to understand it, you know, because keep true to the language more than your own language.
Yeah.
You know? And regardless of what you need to shift.
If you need to shift it, you shift it.
Yes.
Okay, that makes so much sense. Thank you so much for answering that, because I have had that question actually for a long time I am very new-ish in terms of my language journey, and I'm not quite at the point of translation yet.
Yeah,
one day, but not this day.
Beautiful.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you might like to check out others on offer at RTRFM.
Like the award-winning podcast Songlines, chart-topping Sovereign, First Pressing, Mortgage Mag and Favourites Movie Squad.
Plus, don't miss the wild orbit of Planet Perth with Jeff Bullen. Tune in to Australian Melodrama with Libby Noble and meet local authors on Between the Lines with Danielle Raphael.
Head to rtrfm.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to explore on your home of alternative stories, RTRFM.
Continuing discussion about words. So not only are you a writer of music, but in 2015 you published a book via UWA Publishing called Book of the Bohemia Tree, The Life of Kangwa Nagara Olive Knight.
Yes.
What's the book about?
Well, it's my story. I tell my history, you know, mm-hmm. where how I travelled through my life as a child and during my, ever since my birth and inception and birth and then travel through life, because arriving at this, being a musician. Yeah.
What inspired you to write a book about your life? Like, were people asking for it, or was it something that you otherwise felt compelled to do?
Well, it was coupled with both, you know, people asking for it and myself having to sort of kind of be out there. Look, I've got to get my story out, and because there are going to be generations who are going to read it, because I have many greats from my grandchildren, you know.
And
they need to carry on, and they need to hear about their future, I call them my future ancestors. So my future ancestors have to hear of me, you know. Yeah. Oh, that was our ancestor that did this, you know. So so I have eight of them, and I just need them to just carry on the story and remember me that way. And
I think
when I'm gone, you know.
Your story is so interesting as well, because even just listening to you, it's like you've led all these different lives. That have kind of all come together, and there's a real like magical sense to it, all these different lives that you've led.
Yes.
Yeah. You also helped develop the Walmudali Dictionary in the 60s.
Yes.
I've heard little bits and pieces about how like the Noongar Dictionary was put together, and the little I know from that is it's a very complicated process. What was that like doing it for the Walmudali Dictionary? Like what did that look like from what you can tell us?
Well, we had a visit in that year by a couple of missionaries who came, who were from the Summer Institute of Linguistics. And these ladies dived straight into the language, you know, and said, "Oh, let's do this and this and learn the language." And then we started talking about, while the old people were still around with us, and we said, look, let's get into the dictionary. And so sure enough, you know, we worked very hard and getting into the dictionary, because we've had the resources. They were available then, you know, the old people, before they passed on, you know. And so the dictionary is made up of people who were so, you know, it was the knowledge was just there, you know, at our fingertips.
But,
you know, because who knows, like in the future, all of those old people will be gone.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we did it at the right time.
Yeah.
So, and there are old words there that people
have lost.
Lost and will not hear it again, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why when our young, the future generations look at that dictionary now, they'll open it and say, "Oh my word, this is what Walmudali looked like in the past," you know.
It's almost like a time capsule. That's the word. It's almost like a time capsule for what everything looked like in that specific era that it was made.
Yeah, that's right. And all of those old people are gone now.
Yeah.
You know? And had we not done it at the right moment in time, we would have lost a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, if we would have waited a bit too long, you know, put it off and so now, you know, that's a valuable resource for our families and the generations after us.
It's a way to keep it going.
Yes.
What did you learn going through a process? Because you would have been quite young during that process as well. Like, what was that like being a part of and seeing old people speak?
You know, when we did see the words, and they were so, you know, because we lived it at the time, And then you explored further some of the different things like the nouns and the pronouns, and you learnt all about this Western way of looking at language. And then I and a couple of others travelled to New Guinea to meet with specialists there who had worked with other languages all over.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in South America and all those places. So we learned a bit more about how to explore and do research, like almost like a research, but put into perspective what your language
like how was. How to put it on a page.
Yeah, how to put it on a page and how to translate it and how to see the different meanings that, and the connections.
Yeah, spellings
and all that sort of thing. So having to be going through those sort of experiences that really, really enriched my life, you know, has given me this strong kind of strong feeling towards the language and wanted to preserve it for myself and for the future generations, you know.
So cool. And just so, yeah, it's something really special about that. And
I'm glad it's sort of been written into the Western form of, protection, like, you know, being in the archives and all this sort of thing. So if because all of our indigenous, as you know, our indigenous are either verbal enough passed down to us or because nothing's written.
See, no.
Unless it's in paintings and rocks or carvings and all this sort of thing. But even that cannot tell you, give you the full story.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that the Western methods were used, to preserve what we need to preserve for the future generations, you know.
Yeah. Advocacy and research has also been a massive part of your life. Your work has spanned research on understanding FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, campaigning for suicide prevention, especially in your region, which has one of the highest rates of suicide in the world.
That's true.
Where does this drive to speak out come from, and how did you, I think, get started in that space?
Well, far as I'm concerned, I can tell my talk about myself, it is all to do with the lived-in experience.
Yeah.
Being on the community, seeing it day by day, the effects of alcohol and what it has done, even though at the time, my life at the school, having to see the children and the children who came in at different behaviours to the normal children.
Yeah.
And you'd, the education department would term it as ADHD.
Yeah, okay.
And then at the time, and we thought, look, oh, this is not ADHD. There's a huge kind of majority of this behavior and this condition, as it were. And I remember listening sort of randomly by accident. I heard of one woman coming over from the United States, and she was visiting a festival in Queensland, and there she was interviewed on the radio, and she spoke about this strange thing called FASD. And I said to the people in my town in Fitzroy Crossing, look, there's a woman over here who's talking about something that we don't know called FASD. And please get her over here, and let her talk about what happened with her own indigenous people in the United States, because she had studied it so much, and called it fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And when she came over, the women's group in Fitzroy Crossing then had her as a regular invitee, our meetings and all that. So, and she still is, she's involved with us. And I think she lives in California. So then with that came the strong advocacy for setting up research and all that about
resources
and looking at FASD as a real issue of alcohol consumption, the excess.
Yeah,
of alcohol consumption by the mother who carries the baby.
Yeah, I could honestly, this podcast could run for 2 hours, and I would, as much as I would love to go on for 2 hours. Unfortunately, I cannot. Although, to be honest, people would probably listen to you speak for 2 hours. I know I would. So to kind of wrap it up, I suppose, what's your hope for the next generation of storytellers?
Yeah, my hope is that they carry it on, they carry on the storytelling and not only the written, but at the moment I'm very passionate about what I'm doing at the school, in my local school, in the community, where I'm hired for 3 days a week writing lyrics with each of the classes.
And, oh, that's so cute!
Yeah, they are learning in languages, so we hopefully each term we are going to cover 3 languages there in the community.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's Walmajeri, Wangajunga, and Guniandi. So, and also Creole. And I tested it out once with the upper class, and when they wrote their song for the Christmas break, and I said, now let's sing it in Walmajeri and in Creole, you know. So they enjoyed it, you know, because my aim is to see the languages put side by side, you know. When the children are speaking Creole, they think they're speaking standard English, so we really need to sort of recognize the different languages, you know.
Yeah.
And so they said they don't sort of confuse their own languages, you know, like Walmajeri, Wangajeri, and Creole with the language they're learning at school, you know.
Yeah.
So they have all of these side by side.
Oh, that's incredible. I just thank you so much for coming in today. It has been such an honor and a joy to listen to you speak and to meet you properly.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for joining me on this month's episode of Songlines. Our guest today was Kankara Nagara. This episode of Songlines was produced and edited by Danielle Raphael. Our music is by Matakich with artwork by Rayan Ryder. Big thanks to Kobe Arthur Morrison for his production consultation. Next time, photographer Cole Baxter joins me to yarn about his work capturing the staunch spirit of WA's First Nations community.